Hi, I'm Teresa Battiger. I'm one of the ID physicians at the School of Medicine in Indiana. And I'm going to talk about a case that I saw in consultation in the hospital of secondary syphilis presenting as painless jaundice associated with markedly elevated transaminitis. This patient also had a relatively severe penicillin allergy, which precluded its use in his treatment. And I did literature searching, and it doesn't specifically address the treatment of syphilitic hepatitis. However, in this case, doxycycline was administered with resolution of this patient's symptoms. So, the case presentation, this is a 28-year-old HIV-negative male who presented to the ED with painless jaundice, which was noted by a family member a day prior to presentation. He had associated pruritus. Fatigue, nausea, and vomiting were noted about 2 to 3 days prior to presentation. He had no preceding diarrhea, no other changes in his bowel habits. He denied any preceding illness or febrile illness. He had no unexpected weight loss or change in appetite. Additionally, he reports that he rarely drinks alcohol and does not use acetaminophen very often, and he had no recent travel outside of the United States. So on review of systems, he noted fatigue, his sclera were ecteric. By the time he presented to the hospital, his nausea and vomiting had resolved. He had zero abdominal pain. He was not having diarrhea. He had no rectal pain. When asked about genitourinary symptoms, he denied any kind of ulcerations or discharge or any kind of lesions in that area. He did have a rash, which he can't remember when that developed, pruritus and alopecia. Although when you talk about the alopecia, that's been ongoing for years, so probably not related to the case. He really had no pertinent past medical history, surgical history, or family history. His allergy history was penicillin associated with hives and lip and tongue swelling, and he thinks maybe a cephalosporin allergy as well. He was not taking any home medications when he presented to the hospital. As far as social history is concerned, he lives with his mom and his two brothers. There are cats in the home. No recent travel. He's currently unemployed but wants to start his job in fast food, which he cannot do while he is jaundiced. He denies ever using tobacco, rare alcohol use, never any illicits, and as I stated before, minimal acetaminophen use. His sexual history was obtained when I got called day 4 of hospitalization. No one had talked to him about this. He reported about 35 lifetime partners, with 30 of those partners being in the last year. He had a major stressor about a year prior to presentation. He's had 12 partners in the last 3 months. All of them are men. He engages in both receptive and insertive anal sex and gives and receives oral sex. His condom usage is intermittent at best, and the majority of his more recent partners have been anonymous. Physical exam on admission, so this was done prior to me seeing him. He was tachycardic and hypertensive. He had ecteric sclera. His mucous membranes were yellow. His abdominal exam was completely benign. His genitourinary exam, which I performed when I saw him, was negative. And he had the fairly characteristic macular papular rash that you would expect with secondary syphilis. And then he was a pumpkin. He was pretty yellow when I saw him. So because of the jaundice, his initial workup was initiated in the ER. So his electrolytes were completely normal. However, his alkaline phosphatase was mildly elevated. His AST, ALT, and bili were markedly elevated. CBC was normal. They checked Tylenol level, which was negative. His urine drug screen was negative. And given the jaundice, he underwent the standard abdominal pelvis CT, which really didn't show much. He had some periportal edema and some prominent periportal and retroperitoneal lymph nodes that were noted. So because he had markedly abnormal liver function tests and transaminases, additional workup was initiated prior to me seeing him. They did the standard viral hepatitis panels, which were negative. They repeated his HIV test, which was negative. He had viral serum PCRs, including CMV, HSV, and EBV performed, which were all negative. His RPR was sent but not back when he had his MRCP done, which showed some intrahepatic periductal edema. and some prominent periportal lymph nodes. He had his liver biopsy done around the same time his RPR came back positive. So his liver biopsy showed acute hepatitis associated with severe lobular inflammation, moderate portal inflammatory infiltrate, and diffuse bile duct injury. He had some moderate cholestasis noted as well. So I got called around day four. So day three, his RPR returned positive. They started him on doxycycline given his penicillin allergy. They called me day four because instead of going down, his liver enzymes went up again, and they were concerned that the doxycycline was contributing to this. And I did not think that the doxycycline was contributing to this, so I had them continue. The question was, should we desensitize him and give him penicillin instead? However, his LFT stabilized prior to discharge. I saw him a week post-therapy, and his liver function test had markedly decreased. And then he saw his primary care doctor approximately 3 weeks post-therapy, and it was almost completely, they were within the normal limits almost. When I saw him a week post-therapy, his RBR was unchanged, but it had not increased. And then he was supposed to follow up with me to have a repeat RPR and discuss PrEP, given his sexual risk factors. But he did not show up, so I do not have any further data for this gentleman and his RPR. So in the hospital, I had not ever seen a case of hepatitis caused by syphilis, so I did some literature searching to try to better inform the hospitalist docs who had called me. Usually it's due to the dissemination of the spirochetes related to secondary syphilis. The incidence is unknown, although it's thought that subclinical elevations of liver enzymes can be seen in approximately 50% of patients. When you have symptomatic hepatitis, what they typically report is disproportionately elevated alkaline phosphatase compared to the aminotransferases, and typically the bilirubin is within the normal limits. And then the histology, if liver biopsy is done, shows some portal inflammation. You may see some hepatocellular necrosis, granulomas, and very rarely do you see the cholestatic picture. So there really isn't that much data that I could find. Most of them were case reports and case series. Almost all the cases were reported with some form of liver abnormality. The classically reported disproportionately elevated alkaline phosphatase, normal bilirubin, mildly elevated transaminases were reported most commonly. However, there have been several reports that have shown the cholestatic picture, which is what my patient presented with. Liver biopsies were obtained intermittently in the case reports and case series. The Worth and Starry stains were always reported, but only intermittently, rarely positive. They also reported intermittent necrosis, hepatocellular swelling, and some bile duct proliferation. In addition, the case reports, the treatment was not standardized. It was based on what the physicians who saw the patient wanted to do. So some of them received benzathine penicillin times one. There was a case report where the patient actually had to proceed to liver transplantation who received penicillin for over a month. Some patients received doxycycline alone, and then some of the patients received a combination of benzathine, penicillin, and doxycycline. Almost all the patients had complete resolution of their symptoms with the therapy that was provided. I also wanted to look at doxycycline as treatment for this type of infection. There have been studies that looked at the serologic response rates comparing doxycycline to benzathine penicillin and just early syphilis. The serologic response rates were fairly similar, 68% to 97% for penicillin, and then the 65% to 100% for doxycycline. The 65% to 68% response rate were seen more often in the HIV positive patients. If the patients were HIV negative, the response rates were in the mid to upper 90%. But none of these studies specifically address hepatitis related to syphilis. So my patient is a little bit notable, had a cholestatic picture, evidence of secondary syphilis on exam, and a penicillin allergy that precluded its use unless we were going to desensitize him. The documentation of treatment of hepatitis related to syphilis in the literature is minimal, especially when penicillin is contraindicated. However, for this patient, his liver abnormalities rapidly improved following treatment with doxycycline, so it probably is fine to use doxycycline to treat hepatitis related to syphilis when necessary. Mm-hmm. I'd like to thank Dr. Fortenberry, who told me to present this case. Dr. Arno, who I called when this case came through, and then the DIS folks who came actually to the hospital to interview my patient for me. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, so we have our panel here, and there's a bunch of interesting teaching points. First of all, I'd like to first start with Ina, you know, taking a more public health approach. This is a guy who basically had, by the time the diagnosis was made, he had had a CT scan, right, an ERCP, and a liver biopsy, which probably ran up a bill of, God knows, to, you know, $20,000 to $30,000, maybe even more if it was in a bigger urban center. So how would you approach, you know, how do you address these issues from, you know, more of a macro scale?
I mean, I think all we can do, and I know this is obviously very downstream, but, you know, coming back again to working with our providers, and I think if this is a huge role that the training centers can play, is an RPR is dirt cheap compared to all of the invasive procedures and the imaging that this person had. And so, I mean, and we do try to instill that in our residents for sure, is really starting with the basics before escalating to these really invasive and expensive procedures. I mean, obviously the system spent a lot of money diagnosing this particular case, which, you know, perhaps could have been ruled out by just doing an RPR. But again, this is sort of a zebra among zebras. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that, given also the cholestatic picture with this patient, it's not even classic for mm-hmm. syphilitic hepatitis. So, you know, probably some amount of workup was warranted, but this was obviously, you know, they went full court press when maybe waiting for the RPR, and a stat RPR would have been great in this case.
Teresa,
as well.
Did the hospitalists, when this guy was admitted, did the hospitalists have a sexual history on him? Okay, so
yeah.
I think,
and then the sexual history costs nothing
this was a sexual history which should have set off a bunch of bells and whistles on this guy, and I think it actually speaks to the problem that we have in terms of hospitals. To be fair to the hospitalists, though, in terms of, they are bound by length of stay, and they need to get everything done in 2 or 3 days. So they may actually line up. Part of this, they may line up a lot of these things.
Yeah.
But I think an RPR, as Ina points out, is really cheap. Should have been headed off.
Yeah, and one thing that was not mentioned on the sexual history but probably was asked was about oral anal contact, because denied. Yeah, I mean, and, you know, one of the things that we have mentioned as well, you know, to our providers, we try to educate them about, is just the fact that, you know, obviously, I was thinking at first when I read this, oh, this might be acute hepatitis, you know, viral hepatitis. But that's why sort of asking the sexual history is so important. And I'm not going to say that in public health I've given up on providers actually doing that. but I do have to say that we are thinking a lot at the health department about other ways to work with providers to routinize sexual history taking in a way that it's not reliant on providers necessarily. So either through various technologic interfaces, and I think we saw in the plenary session yesterday, you know, folks taking their own sexual histories either through a paper-based form or through an iPad, so that it's not incumbent on the provider to do so, because I think all of us know that it's very challenging for providers to take sexual history routinely. Not us, I'm thinking in the room, but for other providers, there's just a discomfort there and pressure for time that I think precludes people from often taking a sexual history, which could have done a lot in this case.
Okay. Susan, two questions to you. One is, how would you, from as an internal, having just being the closest to internal medicine than any of us, how would you approach this person from an internal medicine standpoint in terms of the presenting symptoms, in terms of a differential? And the other question, which actually Kim was barreling in my ear, was, could this be acute hepatitis C?
So, yeah, so interesting. So I'm not so close, but maybe, but of course, closer than many. So in terms of approaching it from an internal medicine standpoint, well, I think, again, the first point is that I think people don't often think about, or at least internal medicine doctors don't often think about syphilis as a cause of hepatitis. So that's important to remember. I think other things to think about in this case, certainly, of course, the various hepatitides, which were appropriately tested for. I would also think about things like a portal vein thrombosis that could have been potentially ruled out with an ultrasound, which would have been a little bit less invasive than the liver biopsy. In terms of acute hepatitis C, of course, as we all know, hepatitis B is much more likely to present with a very significant elevation in the transaminases, but hepatitis C can do it as well, and as certainly we've seen that in a couple of cases. It's much more rare, but I think that that's certainly on the differential. And then I guess just one more point. So a colleague of ours, Jack Van Bork.
And how would you test for acute hepatitis C? What's the test for acute hepatitis C in this setting?
So really the viral load would be probably the best thing to do because the antibodies, you know, of course, may be positive but may not be. Right, and so I just wanted to make one more point, which is a colleague of ours, Jacqueline Bork, who's I think now over at University of Maryland, published a case, and I know you cited her paper, where she had a patient with syphilitic hepatitis. Now, that one had a more classic picture with a very elevated ALK-phos and relatively low transaminases in bilirubin, but that patient also had a very difficult time getting diagnosed, and I think because people weren't thinking about the diagnosis. So it took a very long time with a lot of invasive tests similar to this case, and so I think it's important to have it on the differential.
Khalil, you have probably more than any of us looked at the ancient literature, on syphilis. And I'm curious what, you know, because I think we saw some, you know, one of the questions that was that I was thinking of when Teresa was presenting this, which actually she answered in part, was what proportion of patients with early or primary or secondary syphilis have LFT abnormalities? So two questions for you is one is what do the ancients have to teach us about this disease? And second, which is an unrelated question, how would you approach the question of penicillin desensitization?
So remember that the ancients weren't able to really test for AST and ALT elevation, but you remember that. And so most of the data really are more modern than ancient, but the data, exactly as you presented, in series with asymptomatic sort of patients, up to 50% will have elevations in their mainly alkaline phosphatase, some elevations in AST and ALT. Some data to suggest that HIV-infected patients may be more likely to manifest that than HIV-uninfected patients, but again, very small numbers. I don't know if I buy that. In most cases, we don't test for it because the patients are completely asymptomatic, and we treat them for early syphilis, and the 2.4 million units is perfectly acceptable. Just as an interesting maybe corollary or addition, we had a similar case to your case with classic though features: elevated alkaline phosphatase in a young gay man, AST ALT mildly elevated, T-billy not elevated, the patient, they quickly made a diagnosis of syphilis, but they in the ED they had done a CT scan and they found a mass in his liver. It was a huge mass, it was 10 centimeters, and the patient had also hepatitis C, had a history of hepatitis C, and so they said there are two processes, there's a mass and then he's got syphilitic hepatitis. They treated him immediately with 2.4 million units of benzathine penicillin G, and they took him to IR to make a diagnosis of hepatocellular carcinoma in this young guy. And they essentially sent him home after that, and they said you can follow up. Histology looked at it and said, and did a Worthen Starry, and it was chock full of treponemes. Essentially, it was an abscess full of treponemes. And they called the patient back, and they called me, and they said, should we use 10 days of IV penicillin? And I said, call him back and see what happened to the abscess. And they called him back about 10 days later. He came back. They did an ultrasound. It had completely resolved. And so it goes to show you that 2.4
said,
million...
said, never mind.
Yeah, never mind. And so that essentially sort of highlights, I think, the importance of and how effective penicillin is in these cases and how broad the presentation is. I mean, that's what makes syphilis
okay.
the best.
2 minutes, would you have desensitized this guy?
No, I think I would have used doxy as well. I would have done exactly what you would have done.
Okay. Any comments, I think, from our panel? I think we've heard this morning about the multiple, any other systems that you were, where syphilis really could present itself with unusual signs and symptoms. I mean, we heard about the eyes, we've heard about liver, any other things that our hospitalists, internists, primary care colleagues should know about, be thinking about.
I mean, you know, the issue is Kim's pointing to her GI tract right now and and gesturing at us. So, I mean, I think the problem with syphilis is that it can manifest in almost any organ system. And so we've talked about the eye. We need to always think about the brain. Kim's pointing to her stomach. We know it can present with renal disease. And obviously there's the skin manifestations. I mean, it really can present in almost any organ system. So unfortunately, we have to, and we heard at last year's ID week about syphilitic aortitis. So it's really, unfortunately.
Okay. Hunter was going to make a point.
Hunter wants to make a point.
We hear the story over the eons of misdiagnosis because of people having a too high threshold for syphilis serology. And I wonder what the role of CDC is and others to change this. At one time, syphilis serologies were done like water, fell off.
Yeah.
HIV, we're now in a position where we've been reasonably successful at getting most docs to have a low threshold. Syphilis has a roughly...
It used to be part of the admission.
I know, and HIV should be, and isn't quite, but it increasingly is getting close, and also on an outpatient basis. And the fact is that the incidence of syphilis is in the same ballpark annually in the U.S. as HIV is, and it's so easy to diagnose, and it's so cheap, as you said, and the notion that CDC or others should begin some sort of fairly intensive proselytization about it. MMWR, go through the professional societies about the importance of having near routinization of syphilis serologies in working up almost anybody for anything.
Maybe we should propose that during the debates that our presidential candidates both get serology tests. All right, I think we're down. So thank everybody. I want to thank our panel, our presenters.